We're talking about the debate over how to tax the wealthiest Americans here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. ProPublica investigated how the ultra-wealthy avoid taxes, and they sifted through a trove of IRS records. The idea of imposing a kind of wealth tax has gained traction among Democrats. President Biden laid out his 2023 budget proposal last week that includes asking Congress to pass a new minimum tax on billionaires.
Right now, billionaires pay an average rate of 8% on their total income. 8%, that's the average they pay. Now, I'm a capitalist, but if you can make $1 billion, great. Just pay your fair share. Pay a little bit.
Do you support a tax on billionaires? How do you feel about your federal taxes? 800-642-1234. Paul Keel covers the IRS and taxes for ProPublica. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thanks.
So President Biden's proposed this new minimum tax on billionaires as part of this budget proposal. Can you explain what this latest approach is to taxing the ultra wealthy?
Sure. So last year we did a series of stories based on a trove of IRS data that we received that contained thousands of the wealthiest Americans. What we were able to do with that was look at people's wealth. So we looked at the wealthiest Americans. We limited our initial story to the 25 wealthiest Americans. So these people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Warren Buffett, etc. And we looked at how much wealthier they got over a period of time. So how much their wealth grew versus how much they ended up paying in income taxes. And the major factor is that you can get vastly more richer without really owing any tax on that if you simply do not do the things that end up on a tax return, namely, if you have lots of stock, selling your stock. But that doesn't mean you can't, you know, have advantages from being so much, you know, wealthier. For instance, you know, it's pretty common, actually very common, to be able to leverage your wealth to borrow against it. So even as you're getting wealthier, you can get very low interest rate loans. You can tap into your wealth in a way that doesn't end up on a tax return. And in that way, you can essentially avoid, or we said, like, you know, sort of sidestep the income tax system. So our major kind of central finding was that we looked at the 25 richest Americans. Over 5 years, they got $400 billion richer and ended up paying about $13 billion in total in income tax, which is a rate like a little over 3%. And that 8% quote that you heard from Biden, after we did our story, the U.S. Treasury did a study that was kind of broader. It wasn't limited to the top 25, and it was an estimate. It wasn't using real data the way that we did. And that's where that 8% number is. It's a similar method. And he used a term that's kind of key there. He said total income. So he's saying, if you get richer, regardless of whether you get richer in a way that ends up on your tax return, that's income. And, you know, it sounds kind of different to people who are used to, you know, our current tax system. But for, like, you know, well over a century, economists have sort of recognized that, you know, if you're getting richer, it's a form of income, regardless of, you know, whether you get it in as simple, a way as we get, you know, wages or something like that. And that's kind of the shift that's at the center of this idea of this minimum tax.
Right. And there's this question over whether a tax on wealth rather than income, whether that is even constitutional. And what about the legalities of this?
Right. So for a number of years, Elizabeth Warren has pushed a wealth tax. And this is, there's a fundamental difference in that a wealth tax just says, okay, you're worth $100 billion. You pay 2% of that. That's what your tax is this year. This tax is on a form of income. So if you're worth $100 billion, but you get $2 billion richer, your income under this tax is $2 billion. It's not, you're not being taxed in the full $100 billion. And so there are scholars, you know, I'm not a, not a legal scholar or a constitutional scholar, but there's scholars who say that this sort of tax has a much better shot, you know, passing the Supreme Court, because it's a way of taxing income. And this sort of issue of whether, you know, you can tax something that's not quote unquote realized. So when you sell your stock, you realize your gains, and the gains we're talking about are unrealized gains. They're gains you just sit on, you know, watch your self-worth go larger, but don't actually convert it into cash. That's not taxed currently. But so the argument is the form of income. So it's not a wealth tax. It's a tax on wealth growth or income.
talking with Paul Keel, who is a reporter covering the IRS and taxes for ProPublica, as we look at taxation for the wealthiest. And your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Brad is here from Lake Mills. Brad, hi. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, hi. I'm glad you're talking about this. I think it's very important. I do think that nothing's going to significantly change until we're able to somehow ban bribery. In our system, there's just the influence of the money is so much greater than the influence of people. We don't really have representative government of people. We have the money running things. So, and I think that's going to take a lot. That's going to take constitutional amendment to get rid of Citizens United. Maybe Buckley versus Vallejo, a lot of the court decisions. And it's going to take democracy. It's going to take people to get in there and stop allowing this corruption.
Brad, thank you for those thoughts. Paul, I'm not sure if you can kind of weigh in there as you see parallels to how money is taxed, how wealth is taxed.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because there's one central idea here is that you can be pretty rich in the sense, like if you're making like a $2 million salary, by anyone's definition, you're doing very, very well for yourself. But we in the system tax salary pretty efficiently. So it's not strictly a story of, you know, rich versus poor, although that is largely, that's a big part of it. You know, if you make your money in a way, so there's sometimes tax, like, you know, analysts talk about the working rich versus the asset rich. Our system very much advantages the asset rich. So if you're an heir of a vast fortune, you know, you're much better off than if you're someone who's, you know, earning your high salary and that sort of thing. So there's some interesting kind of differences here that kind of go, I mean, anyway, so the big fissure in taxes is whether you're asset rich versus working rich.
You observed that versions of a mark-to-market tax have been proposed in the past, and some Republicans and tax experts have voiced concerns about this idea. First, explain that mark-to-market and, you know, what that means.
Yeah, so that's just similar to what we were talking about before. So the idea is, you know, instead of you having to sell your stock to turn it into income that results in your tax return, you know, anyone who has like a 401k or whatever and looking at their statement, you know, the number is higher now than it was 12 months ago. And that difference would be, so mark to market is like, if you were to sell it today, what would it be worth? That's what the idea is. And there's other parts of the tax code that do this. It's not something that's completely foreign to our way of taxing. So like hedge fund managers, like traders on Wall Street, sometimes are taxed this way for sort of complicated reasons. But the point is, it's not completely foreign to our way of, to our system. It's just something we've never applied to, you know, as an automatic thing. And this would only apply to households that are worth more than $100 million. It's called a minimum tax because they'd have to fill out their normal tax return and then they'd have to do this. And then whatever's more, they would pay that tax.
Well, whether it's 3%, whether it's 8%, you know, that would go a long way for middle-class Americans, lower middle-class Americans. And, you know, despite the public will and all the talking points of Congress and President Biden, why does there never seem to be any progress on this wealth tax issue?
It's a big shift. So there's some fear there. I think we also, yeah, I mean, you know, these are very powerful people with sway for sure. I think there's also, I mean, honestly, you know, American admiration for people who built businesses and this notion that we're going to penalize success somehow. But I think that's sort of belied by how imbalanced our tax system is right now. Like, we're not necessarily talking about even like a progressive tax where the rich would be paying more. It's more kind of bringing them up to a sort of a minimum level that's comparable to people who make a lot less.
And so this particular minimum tax on billionaires is targeting the top 100th of 1% of American households. So not too many there.
Well, I was kind of surprised. They say it's 20,000 households who are worth over $100 million, which in itself, I mean, you know, you know, more than like 20 years ago, to get on the Forbes 400, which is like the 400 richest Americans, you could get on the Forbes 400 if you were under $1 billion. But now you have to be worth several billion to get in the Forbes 400. So the amount of wealth that's concentrated in this country is sort of mind blowing. And, you know, even I, who've been looking at it for like the last several years, I'm surprised.
Yeah. So before we move on, crystal ball here, what do you think that this prospect that President Biden rolled out has legs?
Well, so Joe Manchin came out shortly after mm-hmm. and said that he didn't like the idea. And pretty much he rules Capitol Hill currently. So that would seem to make it not something that has much legs.
But you know, didn't he? This, he did yeah. keep the door open, saying he would like some type of tax. Wasn't that right? Like he kept a door open.
He's been pretty open to raising like corporate taxes, okay. I believe, and some other forms of taxes. Kind of more generic, normal like shifts in tax rates mm-hmm. That don't really get at kind of fundamental issues. And then there's other senators, Democratic senators, who don't like that. So that's why we're at the standstill and they haven't passed anything. We think no president has ever proposed something like this. So we wanted to emphasize that this is like a major shift. This is on the table going forward, and maybe in the future there will be a change like this.
ProPublica's Paul Keel covers the IRS, its ability to administer our nation's tax laws. Should Congress raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans? By the way, how do you file your taxes? With software? Do you have a tax preparer you see in person? How much does it cost to file your taxes? We're going to be talking about tax software. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Paul Keel here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at some of America's tax issues with ProPublica on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Federal Trade Commission last week sued Intuit, the makers of the popular TurboTax filing software. They're taking aim at its ad campaign, insinuating that its software is free for millions of users. Here's one where a man and a woman work together to win a 70s-style game show by repeating one word.
Free. That's right. TurboTax Free is free. Free, 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 free.
That is courtesy of iSpot TV. Do you use tax software to file? Should it be free to file your taxes? 800-642-1234. ProPublica's Paul Keel is with us for about 9 more minutes. Okay, so what is happening here with the FTC and this TurboTax software and these ads?
Right. So, I mean, going back about 2 decades more, you know, TurboTax has been the predominant provider of, you know, consumer tax. And they've had this idea that it's free to kind of hook customers in. And the thing is, what they've always done is kind of drawn an arbitrary line where if you have something in your tax situation that's like a little wrinkle, and like recently it's been something as simple as, do you have student loan interest? Do you have that adjustment? Then you get bumped into like a paying class. But often it's not clear that you're not gonna make it through when you start the process. So you've entered in all your information and then you get to a point where they're like, sorry, you have to go to you know, premium or whatever they call their next paying thing. And then, so that's part of how they pull people in and sometimes, you know, essentially hope that you've made this investment of time and now you're just gonna, you know, pay the $60 or whatever. Although it can be more than that sometimes with state returns. So that's been the model for a really long time. And, you know, what we did a couple of years ago is we told the kind of the full story of this, which is, you know, if you step back, we have this tax system where there are some publicly funded, you know, resources where people can find something called VITA, the Volunteer Income mm-hmm. Tax Assistance Program.
Yep.
People should look it up. But, you know, basically, our system is you have to find some way to file. You have to pay, like, you know, a tax software person, or you have to go to, you know, your local, you know, H&R Block or someplace like that, which is, if you think about it, you know, there's really nothing more basic to being a citizen than paying taxes except for voting, I think. And we have this system because, you know, back in the 2000s when the internet was, you know, starting to really blossom, you know, it was really contemplated in the George W. Bush administration to build something that you know, would have the government essentially make it so you could, you know, sign into a government IRS website and fill out your stuff and be done with it if you had a simple tax situation. And this is something that Intuit, which, you know, back then was selling, you know, CD-ROMs
TurboTax. Yes. Don't you remember those days?
Yes, right, yes.
At the checkout line, and then you got your CD-ROM, you put it in.
Yes, there are still people who use the desktop version, but it's a very small minority of their business now. Now it's all through their website, and they were shifting at that time. And this was obviously a major threat, the idea that the government could do for free what they are charging people to do. And so there was very heavy lobbying on Capitol Hill, like, you know, a lot of scare ideas that the government would like use this information to audit you more effectively and stuff like that. And essentially what came out of this was this program called IRS Free File, which still exists, although it's kind of on its last legs. And the idea is these private companies will do it as sort of a good faith thing. And then because they are offering this service to certain people who are low income, the IRS will sign something saying, we're not going to develop anything to compete with you. So it was like sort of a non-aggression pact. Mm-hmm. And that's been our system for a long time. And the program never took off. It's always been a very tiny sliver of people, like, you know, a vast majority of people can, you know, fit under this, the guidelines. It's usually like something like $60,000, $70,000 or less that you, if you have income under that, you can use it. But there's like basically this secret door, as I call it, like you have to go to this one IRS page. And then if you go there, you can enter through that. And what my colleague Justin Elliott reported a couple of years ago was that Intuit TurboTax was blocking the link to this IRS program, the TurboTax version of this program. So you couldn't go from Google to the TurboTax like on their website. You had to find the secret door to get there. And the reason they did that is they didn't want people like doing the free government program. They wanted people going through their ecosystem where they might, you know, eventually end up paying.
Where they might have to upgrade to the paid product if they have too many things that are triggers that on their filing. So
exactly.
Intuit it says it's going to vigorously challenge the FTC's complaint. You know, on what grounds?
Well, they say, you know, their asterisk, it's always like free asterisk or something. If you look, you know, the asterisk arguments,
the fine,
I guess,
print.
yes, the fine print. There you go. You know, they say that they don't, you know, it's always clear that it's only some tax situations will, you know, run the gauntlet to get to free. And that's been their argument, you know, since this has been happening, which is over two decades now.
How did it feel? The government cites the reporting of ProPublica in its complaint against the FTC. That what did you think about that?
No, that's why we do what we do. it's, you know, this idea that they were blocking Google from, you know, basically scanning their website so people couldn't find the TurboTax free government program version, I think really crystallized for people like there was, you know, some level of deceit in this that's kind of built into this system. And you know, TurboTax is massive and they keep on getting market share as people tend to shift, you know, away from going like to the corner, mm-hmm. you know, CPA or whatever and doing their stuff online. It's a complete dominance of the market there. Like H&R Block has a software version, but you know, it's like only 10 or 15% and TurboTax has a majority of users now who use that stuff and it keeps on growing just gobbled up
Right. Once you have your information and it's just, you know, you roll it over and it's hard to break out from their ecosystem, I guess, if you will. So I'm wondering here, as we are close to time and in tax season about to have to file, what is the best way to file your taxes for free? What would you say to people?
Yeah. So if you are, you know, middle income or low income, the two main options you have are this VITA program, which are volunteers who will do your taxes for you. You can like Google VITA and then you can find your local location. You know, it's like a lot of often like retired CPA people or retired IRS people. I actually have done some this year. People pass a test in order to do the taxes. And then IRS Free File still does exist, but since, you know, our stories, H&R Block and TurboTax have dropped out of the program. And so there are some, you know, smaller companies that are still in the program that you can use. And, you know, it's worth looking at it, but sometimes they like will only do under a certain income. So It's not a great system we have, unfortunately, because, you know, it should be something you could do for free, particularly for tax situations. It's very simple, but it can be sometimes hard to find those resources.
Paul, thank you for joining us and sharing all this reporting. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Paul Keel is a reporter covering the IRS and taxes for ProPublica. Coming up, we take a look at the results of a survey that say Americans are worried about another recession and think that higher prices at the store are changing the way they spend their money. We'll talk with a senior personal finance correspondent from CBC. News Update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Americans are tightening their belts, eating out less, driving less, cutting back on monthly subscriptions. We dig into a new survey from CNBC and Acorns Invest on The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Cherkent. Glad you could be here. How worried are you about rising prices? Do you think there's a recession looming, or is that sentiment overblown? How have you absorbed prices at the pump into your budget? What about the grocery store? 800-642-1234 for your insights. Sharon Epperson is senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC. Sharon, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much, Kate. It's great to be here.
Good morning. You reached in your survey 4,000 Americans on what is going on with what they're feeling here with these rising prices. What were some of those top line takeaways?
Well, one of the most surprising things was how often people think about rising prices. And many of them said that they think about it all the time, because when you consider that we're being bombarded with higher prices at the gas pump, in the grocery store, everything that we are, the services that we want to have, all of the prices are going up. And so it's causing people to think about it constantly. It's also bringing significant worries about what's going to happen next, what other shoe is going to drop. And what was most surprising to me was that 81% of the people that we surveyed said they believe we will have a recession this year. And 89% of those who said that said that they're feeling that they're under more financial stress now than they were a year ago. So people are really hurting. And I'm sure many of the people who are listening is like, what else is new? Tell me something I don't know. But the ways people were cutting back, as you mentioned, was also quite interesting. And seeing that, yes, they're driving, yes, they're eating out less. But when you think about what will you do if these prices continue to go up, those changes were significant for a lot of industries, like the travel industry. About 40% of people said they're ready to cancel a trip or vacation if these higher prices continue. Anecdotally, a lot of folks have put off spring break vacations, not planning summer vacations to travel very far away, because they just don't know how much higher these prices are going to go, and they need to pay for day-to-day expenses.
Well, it's interesting there, because that has serious implications for a huge industry that is travel and entertainment, food. I mean, vacations for many Americans in the summer, that is right around the corner. And this sentiment, this stress and pessimism, is quite high, quite alarming in this report.
It is quite alarming. And that is as we're seeing some better than expected jobs numbers,
yes,
depending on who you talk to and where their jobs are, right? And wages and all of that. But as we're looking at wages going up, and again, this is just anecdotal, but some of the people that we talked to said, you know, when we asked, how are you dealing with these higher prices? And they're like, we're just taking on another job to try to make ends meet. So we may see people with higher wages, not because they got a raise, but because they took on two or three side jobs to pay the bills that they have to pay every month.
And that raise, the money increase in that check might be absorbed by these rising prices, inflation rising so much higher than wages.
Exactly. And as we look for the inflation report, the next one from the Consumer Price Index that will be released next week, we will see how much higher we have gone. But I think some people don't need to wait for a number from the government to tell them that prices are continuing to rise.
I wonder with this survey, you mentioned, you know, the sentiment isn't new, but is this survey perhaps a turning point as you've compared other surveys? I mean, you know, certainly polling is a moment in time. It is, you know, and circumstances shift continually. But I'm wondering, as you look at this survey and you've seen other polls, other assessments, does this mark something new?
Well, I think, well, one of the things that it marks that's new is we also asked about how much the war in Ukraine was impacting people's finances. And more than half of the people said, certainly, we are seeing the effect on our finances by this war. That is something that is different. So when we talk about the great squeeze, which is what we titled this survey, there are so many competing factors. Of course, we have looked at the crunch that people were feeling as they were trying to figure out the pandemic at the beginning. We have, of course, have been seeing these rising prices, but now with the war as well, and now with recession fears as well, there's just a convergence of so many outside forces that people have no control over that is really impacting how they get by day to day. And so what, you know, we are trying to do, and what you can find much more information about this on cnbc.com/investinyou, is what do I do about it now?
Mm-hmm,
you know, you're naming all of these things that I have no control over. So focusing on what you can control and what you can do within your own budget is so very important. And it's a wake-up call. The silver lining is for many people, it is a wake-up call to look at where they're spending. And when I see in the data from our survey that people are switching a monthly subscription or canceling a monthly subscription, I, for one, need to go through my bills. I have a lot of recurring expenses on there that maybe I did because I watched so much streaming. I ordered so many subscription boxes of things during the pandemic. I am going out more now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily need those costs. So it's a time to go through and look at what it may seem like a small thing. I don't have that much control over this inflation, but you do have control over your own spending. And maybe you put the money away. You don't do the vacation that you had initially thought for this summer. But if everything goes better than expected, you'll have an even better vacation next summer that you've already saved for, right? So there are just ways to think about it to make sure that you're able to do what you need to do to cover daily expenses, but also to plan for those fun times, you know, and be able to enjoy the hard-earned money.
Well, and what I'm hearing from you, Sharon, is that you do have the power to go line by line through your statements and make sure that what is there is really necessary right now. That right there is control. Is that right?
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. And that it takes work, though, right? Mm-hmm, it takes discipline. And a lot of times we don't take the time to do that. But I think this is the time to really look at it. And it's also a great time to look at it because, look, we're a few days away from the April 18th tax deadline. So you've already had to go through your expenses, or you will if you're a late filer, like some people. I'm not saying I'm one of them. I'm just saying some people. If you're a late last minute filer and you're now looking at everything saying, wait a minute, what did I do in 2021? I can't do that in 2022. So it's not too late to start making some changes and to think about where your money is going and make sure that it's going where it needs to, of course, but also that you're being strategic about making sure you have enough set aside for emergencies in terms of your cash reserves and for, again, fun things that you want to do, your fun money.
Sharon Epperson with us, senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC, as we look at the takeaways from their recent survey and what you're feeling with your budget and how the rising prices are hitting home. Have you gone line by line through a statement? Do you fear what will happen if prices don't come down soon and what that will mean to your budget? How secure are you feeling financially right now? And what is driving the pessimism or the stress? 800-642-1234 to join in. Before we look at some more tips that we can get from you in terms of savings, you know, when we do have the COVID cases remaining relatively low, I see a lot of signs out there that say back in person, you know, for X event or back in person here. You know, what are the effects of that on the overall economy when cases are low like this?
Well, I think we may start to see some people going back out. But as people go out more, quite frankly, you know, their cases may start to rise again. So I think, you know, some economists are optimistic that this will help spending, right? That people will go out, they will be maybe dining out, maybe going to entertainment, transportation, and those things. But at the same time, as we're seeing higher prices, these rising prices and inflation, people are saying, you know, there's another factor here. Yes, I now can go out because maybe I feel more comfortable, but I can't afford to go out because prices are going up too much. So I think it's this great squeeze that people are going through.
When you look at those gas prices, people do have to commute. If they're in person, frontline workers, they have to get to their job. Sometimes they're not close by. So what would you do if your gas is really eating to your budget right now?
Carpooling, if you can. Making sure that all the errands that you need to do, I know you're exhausted, but on your trip home, you do them then, on the way home, not going back out. You have to really be more thoughtful about when you go out, when you're running errands. Certainly you have to get to work, but there are times when you just run into the store to get this thing or that. You're not going to do that now. You may just have to deal with whatever's still in the house and not get to the grocery store that evening. So I think people are thinking more about when they go out, being more strategic. They're also looking on the various apps that you can go on to figure out where's the cheapest gas in my area. And the line, I will tell you, in my local Costco to get gas is super long because it's one of the least expensive places. But you have to kind of think, am I going to have to drive a long distance to get to the less expensive gas, or, you know, what, make that calculation for yourself. But I think that's what people are doing as they're looking at trying to cut down on gas prices and just being smarter about their gas.
Yeah, being strategic, being very deliberate about where you're going, when you're going, and what you can do on the way. We have CNBC Senior Personal Finance Correspondent Sharon Epperson with us, taking the pulse on how Americans feel about rising prices and these economic headwinds. How secure are you financially to weather these difficult times? Are you driving less, maybe eating out less? What is first to go when you cut expenses? What makes the most difference in your budget? Join in your tips right here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sharon Epperson here in the Ideas Network. Four out of five Americans think that we'll have a recession this year. That is from a new CNBC survey out this week. We are breaking it down on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our country's soaring inflation is hurting household budgets, as we've been talking about. Nevertheless, the IRS still expects us to file our 2021 tax return, pay whatever we still owe, by the filing deadline, which falls on April 18th. So have you done your taxes? Are you worried about your tax bill amid rising prices? What filing questions are on your mind? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. CNBC's senior personal finance correspondent Sharon Epperson with us for about 10 more minutes. So your survey also looked at who is responsible for teaching our kids about household finances, and more than 80% say parents are the ones who've got to do this. Do you think that there are these conversations happening with kids?
Surprisingly, according to our survey, no, they're not. Even though 80% of parents said it is our responsibility to teach our children financial education, only about 40% said that they talk to them about it more than once a month. 31% of the parents that we surveyed said they never talk to their kids about household finances. So you think it's your responsibility, but you never talk about it. And that leads us in a very, very difficult situation. Add to that, even if you are expecting it to be taught in schools, there are only 12 states currently that require a standalone personal finance course in order to graduate from high school. And there are many states and many people that believe, of course, there should be financial education in the schools, but it's just not there. Sometimes they might try to get it into a social studies class. Sometimes they may have it offered as an elective in a high school curriculum. But it is something that actually needs to be an integral part of K through 12 curriculum, yes, you can actually learn about needs versus wants, about delayed gratification and how to spend as a, be a smart spender as early as 5 or 6.
Yes.
And it's not happening. It's not happening.
Though. And certainly, you know, once the child is also earning some money, whether it is from an allowance, I've got a pet sitter at home, I've got a babysitter. And now, you know, making those deposits is really having to start to be part of that routine and looking at their balance. So, but it does. I think there's a time element here, too. You really have to take the time to do it because it's not just going to be something that they learn on their own.
Exactly. You have to make the teachable moment. So, you know, over the course of my children are now 19 and 16, but throughout their lives, because this is something that I'm passionate about, I talked to them about money. So when I had my son as a baby in the front carrier, and I turn around to look out and see the world as we're walking through the grocery store, I'm also talking about the peas and how I'm looking at the unit price to make sure that I don't just buy the piece because they're on sale, but I look at the unit price because that actually tells me how much I'm getting for how much money, and I want to get the lowest price and the best deal. Mm-hmm. And part of it, which I had no one to talk to because I was home on maternity leave with this little baby, but I think from an early age through osmosis, he's learned that. They went with me when I went to buy a refrigerator, and I went with them to show them specifically, if you hang on the door, on the handle of this refrigerator and break it, that is however much that price tag was. I can't remember now, but I wanted them to know. And people are like, why would you tell your kids how much a refrigerator costs? I'm like, who goes to the refrigerator the most in your house? You know, I have two growing children, and that's the kids. And now at 19, he has had summer jobs for several summers. He has a Roth IRA that he puts his summer money in. He goes to coupon websites to make sure that he buys nothing full price. Because these are the lessons that I hope that I've taught to him, but this is the way that I manage my finances, and I talked to him about it. Hmm. And the other key thing that we talked about, because this is the biggest expense probably so far in his life, and maybe it will be for a long time, is college. Mm-hmm. And talking specifically about, this is how much, you know, the first tuition bill, he was like, is this a mistake? I'm like, no, this is not a mistake. This is how much college costs. We've talked about this, but you need to see the number. And I know some parents may say, that's a lot of pressure on kids. You know, we're working for our kids and try to help them. But no, everyone's involved in filling out the FAFSA. Everybody's involved in understanding the return on the investment. Everyone's involved in terms of figuring out the price tag. So those conversations are so very important. And Kate, I need to tell you about this really exciting thing I did yesterday, which was have a conversation about financial education with 3 governors. Ooh. So there's no federal mandate for financial education. This comes from the states. It's up to each state what they want to do in their school system. And talking to the governors in New Jersey and Nevada and Mississippi, and hopefully one day I'll talk to the governor of Wisconsin about this as well. It was interesting that they all agreed that the most important lesson that they would teach the kids if they were the teacher for the day for a personal finance class is to pay yourself first, mm-hmm. to think mm-hmm. about where you are and where you want to be and make sure that you're paying yourself and saving for yourself to make that happen. And I thought that's such an important lesson, and it's not something that you have to wait till 11th grade to learn. You can start teaching that to a kid again in kindergarten. So, you know, interesting how each state had a different way that they are teaching financial education. New Jersey starts in middle school. They've mandated 6th, 7th, and 8th graders have to take a personal finance class. Mississippi has a college and career readiness course that you must take before you can graduate from high school. And Nevada has worked it into their social studies curriculum. But they all come together as Democrat and Republican governors to say, this is important.
Taking
and I think
a stance
that
on
is,
it,
you know,
yes.
We don't have very many issues where parties come together on, but I think in terms of financial education, they agree it's important. It's just trying to figure out how to do it in their states.
Talking with Sharon Epperson, senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC. Let's bring on Beth now in La Crosse. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. What's your recommendation?
Hi. Yeah, I have a book that we bought when my son was a lot smaller. He's 11 now. It's called The Opposite of Spoiled. I don't like the title, but it's a great strategy. And the author discusses having 3 jars that when your child gets money through allowance or gifts or money they've earned, they split it up between those three jars. And the three are spend, save, and share. And so through that, he has learned to think ahead about what he would like to save for. He has a jar of money so that spend, so that if there's something he really wants that we don't want to, we're okay with him getting, but we don't want to pay for, he can get in the moment. And then share has been amazing to help him think through who, what organizations, what people, what animals he wants to support that are nonprofits.
That is so great. What has he shared? Give an example.
Yeah. So last year during COVID stuff, he and I did a homeschool unit on Afghanistan. And so with the refugees coming over, we shared with the Toma organ, you know, the folks in Toma who were hosting the refugees. He shared with the different animal-based organizations. His one he just brought up 2 days ago was wanting to share with organizations that are helping to stop the environmental destruction.
Oh, Beth, thank you so much. Sharon, what do you make of these three jars?
I love those three jars. And I've done something similar with my kids when they were younger as well. And it's the share part is just so powerful because it's not all about you. Yes, you should pay yourself first, but you also have to make sure that others are able to achieve their financial freedom, whether it's through an organization or donating to an individual or someone who has lost things in the fire in their home, or someone who is trying to travel and do some type of charitable work overseas and they need, you know, there's a GoFundMe and there's some type of account to try to help them. So I think it's really important for kids to learn that early.
We only have about a minute left, but can you give us some quick tax filing tips that you have top of mind?
Definitely file on time. Mm-hmm. April 18th, you get three extra days. Definitely file. Even if you owe and don't think you have the money, pay something. Make sure that you pay something because not filing is a huge penalty. And you'll have to pay a percentage of the taxes that you owe, a penalty on that. But in addition to the fact, if you think that you don't have the money, there is a payment plan that you can sign up for through the IRS, irs.gov. And there are ways that they will work with you, but you need to make sure that you file. And then also, keep in mind that there's some COVID tax breaks you want to make sure that you file about correctly, whether that's the recovery rebate credit or the advanced child tax credit. And if you have been a sharer and you have made charitable contributions, know that you do not have to itemize to write off $300 if you're an individual, $600 off your taxes in terms of that charitable contribution. You can take that right off top with a standard deduction. And if you itemize, up to 100% of your adjusted gross income is what you can write off in terms of charitable contributions. So there's a real tax advantage to sharing as well. And I think that that's important for people to know.
Sharon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Sharon Epperson is Senior Personal Finance Correspondent for CNBC. We have a link to the CNBC and Acorn survey. It's at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.